who administer the oath of office.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States, that you will conduct yourself as an attorney and counsel in this court, uprightly and according to the laws of your country?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations. You join more than 33,000 who have served as members of our bar, and it appears that we'll be hearing from you quite shortly. Welcome. The court now calls the case of United States against Taylor. Is counsel for the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Brian Miser, and I represent the appellant, Sergeant Jason Taylor. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
The marital communications privilege itself is at stake in this case. Since its inception, Manning for Courts Martial has provided an exception to that privilege in cases involving crimes against one's spouse. And since 1965, this court has limited that exception to crimes which satisfy, or to those, pardon me, which have a direct connection to the personal property of the other spouse, but not to those that have only involve an outrage to the sensibilities of the other spouse or a violation of the marital bonds. The lower court declined to follow this 42-year-old precedent and provided for a judicial elimination of the marital communications privilege. And that is precisely what this court warned of in United States versus Massey, where this court stated, quote, if the exception to the privilege is not limited to a direct invasion of the wife's rights, the rule will soon judicially be eliminated, end quote. And that's quite correct, because any number of offenses could satisfy the lower court's test, for instance, those that, quote, strike directly at the institution of marriage, end quote, or those that, quote, result in significant disruption of the lives of the two married persons and any children of the marriage. For instance, the military crime of fraternization could be considered now a crime against the spouse under the lower court's expansive definition. This court should decline to follow that expansive definition and instead turn to Judge Ferguson's extensive survey of the common law in United States versus Massey. For it is there you will find the case of Stein v. Bowman, where the Supreme Court in 1839 held that the exception to the privilege was limited to those offenses which are against the person of the other spouse. You will find the Supreme Court's case in Bassett v. United States, an 1890 Supreme Court case, dealing with the exception as it was codified by the Utah legislature, dealing with identical language at issue in this case, and where the Supreme Court rejected the lower court's holding that polygamy was a crime against the spouse. It is there that you will also find the Second Circuit's decision, 1949 decision in the United States versus Walker, which Judge Learned Hand again surveys the common law and finds that this crime, the exception to this privilege, is a crime against the person of the spouse. This exception certainly dates back to 1631. In the case of Lord Audley, where Lady Audley was permitted to testify over her husband's objection because her husband had allowed his friends to repeatedly rape her. And that is the common law exception. That is the tradition that has come from English and American common law. And as this court stated in United States versus McCollum, it was this common law tradition that Military Rule of Evidence 504 and its predecessor in the previous manuals for court martial, 1969 and 1951, that the manual was intended to codify. And you see much of that reflected in paragraph 148E of the 1951 and 1969 manuals for court martial. In the 1959-51 manual, you see the crime of assault specifically delineated, the first list of offense in that paragraph. You also see the crime of white slavery under the White Slavery Act, or as is commonly now known as the Mann Act. So the crime of prostitution is also included in there.
Counsel, you mentioned the 1969 manual. What language are you referring to in the 1969 manual?
The 1969 manual also mentions assault, Your Honor.
In terms of adultery?
The 1969 manual does mention adultery. That language was specifically added in there.
So we have, at least in the period following 1969, the rule existing in courts martial that adultery would be an exception?
It's unclear, Your Honor. It is unclear. It is unclear, and as you know, this... This resulted in ultimately the military rules of evidence being adopted and eventually the 1984 manual, because it wasn't clear from the 1969 manual or the 1951 manual what was in fact positive law or what was just the framers or the drafters including their thoughts on the subject.
But in fact, what was unclear about the president stating in the 1969 manual that the privilege does not exist? And then after the words does not exist includes a list of matters, including adultery.
Well, Your Honor, what is unclear is precisely what Professor Lederer said in an article commemorating the 10th anniversary of the drafting of the MREs. And he said, quote, the drafter's intent in drafting the new military rules of evidence was clear and plain. The new rules were to function as positive law rather than as a useless summary of what the drafters thought the law to be. And so,
so you're referring to the entirety of the 1969 manual as just a summary of ideas as opposed to statements of positive law? What in our case law would, from that period, before 1984, would say that everything in the 1969 manual was merely just a collection of ideas as opposed to matters that included statements of positive law?
Massey and Rayner, Your Honor, would say that
everything in the manual?
Not everything in the manual. Everything within that paragraph, Your Honor, was merely salutary, according to the holding in Massey and Rayner. And this court in Menchaca said that whatever happens with the rest of that language in paragraph 148E, crimes against the children are specifically an exception to that privilege. And then the court specifically declined to address the other language, adultery, assault, well, assault speaks for itself, but adultery, bigamy, polygamy, that other language that is in paragraph 148E, and left that for another day. But this court need not accept the government's invitation to wade into this perhaps interesting debate historically, because the manual was changed roughly 11 years later in 1980. And when you see what has changed...
Lieutenant, didn't the manual, didn't the drafters in 1980 and the MRE comments say that they're taking the substance of paragraph 148E of 69 with an exception not here relevant?
Well, Your Honor, They do say that they are going to take a certain language from the 1969 manual, and in fact they do that. And in exceptions to MRE 504, you see crimes against the children from the 1969 manual. You see prostitution from the 1951 and 1969 manual. And then you see common law crimes against the spouse. That's what's left. When the drafters for the military rules of evidence redrafted the military rules of evidence, they...
Did they sub silentio overrule the 69 manual?
Well, Your Honor, it is within the president's discretion to change the manual as he sees
it. It is indeed. And he says, I quote from the drafter's comments, the rule is similar to 1969 manual paragraph 148E, but has deleted the limitation of the exceptions to privilege to matters occurring after marriage or otherwise unknown to the spouse as being inconsistent with the intent of the exceptions. That's the only difference they cite.
That's right, Your Honor. Appellant concedes that it is similar to paragraph 148E. It's missing adultery. And additionally, much more language that is in paragraph 148E. But MRE 504 brings the military rule of evidence in line with the common law, with two exceptions, that dealing with prostitution and that dealing with crimes against the children. And as this court held in the column, it was this common law tradition that the military rules of evidence were intended to codify.
Counsel, is there a common law definition of what it means for a crime to be against the person or a property of another?
There is not, Your Honor. But if you look to the Supreme Court's cases in Bassett and earlier in Stein v. Bowman, this is illustrated. And if you look at Bassett, it's nearly directly on point. Pardon me, because the Supreme Court there deals with the crime of polygamy, a problem in Utah in the late 19th century, and the court deals with the attempts by the legislature to bring that within the exception to privilege. And the court holds that that is not within the common law definition of a crime against the spouse.
But my question is different. Do we have to decide that adultery isn't a crime against the spouse in order to decide this case? Can't something be a crime against the spouse and not be a crime against the person?
Two exceptions, Your Honor, and that would be crimes against the children and prostitution, Your Honor. Those would be the two exceptions.
So you don't think that against the person naturally means crimes such as battery, rape, murder, assault, and things of that nature?
Against the spouse, Your Honor, crimes against the spouse. So if.
But what does the language of the current exception read? Does it read against the spouse or does it read against the person or property?
It reads against the person or property, Your Honor.
And what I'm asking you is, isn't there a difference or not?
There is not, Your Honor.
So there's not a difference between something being a crime against the spouse and something being a crime against the person?
No, Your Honor, there is not.
Counsel, in response to my earlier question about the meaning of the 1969 manual, you cited a number of cases, Massey and Rayner. Both those cases predated the 69 manual. What case stands for the proposition that the words in the 1969 manual were not intended to, in that paragraph, were not intended to set forth positive law?
It's certainly implied in United States versus Menchaca, Your Honor, where this court declines to rule that expansively that all of the language in the 1969 manual is in fact positive law. And you will note that Judge Ferguson, which authored Massey, joins Menchaca, but joins Menchaca, I believe, because it is limited to that narrow holding, that the President had expressed a determination to include crimes against the children, as did the federal rules of evidence that ultimately were never adopted, to bring into the realm of positive law that specific exception. But the court never addressed the issue of whether adultery was, and in fact the court expressly declined to do so, and this court need not now engage in that albeit interesting debate.
Counsel, what's the juridical status of the manual?
It is military rule of evidence 504, Your Honor.
No, that's not what I'm asking. What is the juridical status of expository language in the manual for courts martial?
The language in the manual today is positive law, Your Honor.
Okay. What was the juridical status of the 69 manual in, say, 1970?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't know.
Is the answer. And no one knew is the problem, which ultimately led to the drafting of the military rules of evidence, as Professor Lederer said in that 1990 article, and what ultimately led to the manual for courts martial in 1984, where we for the first time have rules for court martial, where we have the military rules of evidence, and these things are positively delineated, and so that for the first time we know what is in fact positive law and what isn't just the drafters waxing eloquently about what they think the law is.
Counsel, my recollection is that this court held, I believe it was in a case called Ware, raised some questions about the meaning of the manual, and Congress in the early 1970s amended Article 36 to expressly provide that the President had the authority to provide rules of pretrial, trial, and post-trial procedure. And so in what sense, including modes of proof, the rules of evidence, so in what sense would any aspect, with all due respect to Professor Lederer, would any aspect of the rules of evidence that were set forth in the manual for courts martial in 1969 not constitute binding law?
Your Honor, this court left that question in United States versus Menchaca. Unfortunately, there is not a decision interpreting this paragraph after Menchaca, before McCollum.
Is there any case which stands for the proposition that any provision of the 1969 manual dealing with rules of evidence did not constitute positive law?
Other than that, which I've mentioned is implied in Menchaca, Your Honor, no, there is none.
Okay, thank you.
Lieutenant Meisner, I have a question. In your reply brief on page 3, you talk about the fact that statutes creating privileges are to be liberally construed and go on then to say that exceptions, therefore, would normally be narrowly construed. Do you recall that?
Yes, Your Honor. That's out of the Supreme Court of Iowa, a case.
And would the flip side of that be that if the rule was actually that statutes creating privileges are to be narrowly construed, that then the existence of, that the exceptions would be liberally construed?
That's right, Your Honor.
Isn't that the law of this court and the Supreme Court of the United States?
With respect to the first marital privilege, Your Honor, I believe that was addressed in Trammell, and that is the state of the law with respect to the testimonial marital privilege. But this court has never addressed that with respect to the communications privilege.
Well, what are the policy arguments with regard to whether rules of privilege should be broadly or narrowly construed?
Well, Your Honor, the policy arguments are that it is for the policymakers to interpret these privileges, and that this court should not lightly impute meaning into these privileges. As this court stated in McCollum, given the significant social and legal policy implications extending the privilege, we would expect such an intent to be represented in express language rather than pressed or squeezed from the present text. Now, you will recall in McCollum, this court was dealing with a de facto child exception, something that makes perfect sense, something that the president could, in fact, if he wished to, put in express language in the manual. He has not done so since McCollum, and he has not done so with the case of adultery since the 1969 manual for courts martial. And so this court should narrowly construe the privileges. As the Supreme Court said in Bassett v. United States, we do not doubt the power of the legislature to change this ancient and well-supported rule, but an intention to make such a change should not lightly be imputed.
Well, in dealing with de facto child, the question there was, is a de facto child a de jure child? At least the majority of the court had a particular view on that. But in terms of the case that we're dealing with here, we're talking about this this impact on the marriage, on the person. Isn't that a matter of interpretation for this court?
It certainly is a matter
of... Okay, and then if it is a matter for interpretation of the court, following up on Judge Ryan's question, what is the policy that we should be applying in interpreting a rule? What would be the arguments for interpreting not following the theory that privileges should be interpreted narrowly so as to admit the greatest possible evidence in the truth-finding process of a trial? Why would you interpret a privilege in that sense broadly, thereby excluding evidence from a trial?
It is the reasoning in Bassett, which I previously quoted, Your Honor, and that this court seemingly follows in McCollum, which is, again, that you would expect to follow the plain language that the president and those responsible for setting out this privilege have put in the manual for courts martial. Now, it is certainly a rule of this court to interpret that manual, but as the court said, you would expect this exception to be listed in express language rather than squeezed from the present text, and that is what the lower court has done here. It is squeezed into the present text any number of offenses under this broad definition that strikes directly at the institution of marriage. Any number of offenses can qualify under that, to where you essentially have no marital communications privilege remaining, because any number of offenses, the prosecutor could come in and ask the spouse whether this impacted the marriage, whether it impacted the children of the marriage, and you would ultimately be left with...
Well, I understand the camel's nose under the tent, or however we want to characterize that. Why should that ever be a difficult question with respect to adultery?
Well, Your Honor, because as this court stated in Bassett, that the crime is in fact humiliation to her or outrage to her is evident, but that's not enough, because as the court stated, is she less sensitive, is she less humiliated when the spouse commits murder or robbery or forgery than when he commits polygamy or adultery? And in Bassett, this court said that polygamy, in language identical to the privilege in this case, said that polygamy was not a crime against the spouse under the common law exception to that privilege. And therefore, the language in this case also should not be considered to be a crime against the spouse.
I'm sorry. Going back to earlier questions I was asking you, is humiliation stemming from adultery a crime against the person or property of the spouse?
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay, so there is a difference, there could be a difference between a crime against the spouse and a crime against the person or property of the spouse, or not?
I think so, Your Honor, yes.
So, for example, if someone was to kill my mother, if my husband was to kill my mother, that would be a crime against the marriage, or it would be offensive to me and upsetting to me, but would it be a crime against my person?
It would not, Your Honor. And it is that crime against the person that the common law exception exists for, and it was that crime against the person exception that the military rule of evidence was, that this privilege was intended to codify.
So what do we do about the language, the language discussing the change to the rule? That says that it essentially means to be the same as the prodigal.
Well, Your Honor, there is a qualifier in that sentence, which is that it takes much from the 1969 manual, but it takes not everything from the 1969 manual.
What does it not take?
Adultery, Your Honor. It doesn't take.
On what basis do you make that assertion? It doesn't say that.
But what it does say, Your Honor, is it specifically has qualifications for crimes against the spouse, and it has it specifically lists prostitution and also crimes against the children. Language from that paragraph. If the drafters of Military Rule of Evidence 504 intended to take a cookie-cutter version of the 1969 manual and plug it right into MRE 504, it would have had a lot more exceptions than are currently in Military Rule of Evidence 504. They do not. And so this court should not squeeze that language into present rule in military rule.
So we should take the language in its plain meaning.
That's right, Your Honor.
Right.
Yes,
but, Your Honor. But you're arguing just the opposite with regard to the 69 manual. You're saying it's basically the vaporizings of theorists.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is that we don't know what was positive law in the 1969 manual, and that's why we had to eventually go to the military rules of evidence. That's why we had to go to the 1984 manual, which is the sea change, where we first have positive law stated in the rules for courts-martial.
Are you arguing that the crime against the person has to be physical?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the common law exception. It has to be a physical crime, perhaps with the exception of maybe an offer type assault, which still does involve some immediate threat to the person. But that is the narrow privilege that the common law allowed. And we're backing important policy considerations that have been distilled through centuries, Your Honor, to protect the marriage. And if you think that this is the ideal case for the justification of this privilege, because adultery may in fact be the most common crime in the military, although this court doesn't often see it. And the Marines who are out there right now committing adultery, the sailors that are committing adultery, need to know that when they recognize the error of their ways, that they can go to their spouse and forthrightly concede that and attempt for the sake of the marriage, for the sake of the children, to repair that marriage. It is that it is that public policy concern that drives this privilege. And the Marine that's confessing his wife that he has committed adultery and wishes to salvage the marriage, which is exactly what happened in this case, needs to know that the United States government is not also a party to that conversation.
So in your view, it doesn't matter whether you focus on humiliation. It doesn't matter if there's lifelong mental anguish or injury. Your focus is on the fact that there is not in fact physical injury.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You consider adultery to be an anti-marital act?
It certainly is, Your Honor.
How would you then deal with the language in the discussion for Rule 504?
Well, I wouldn't consider a marital act.
Where it says specifically, subparagraphs A and C deal with the anti-marital acts which are against the spouse and thus the marriage.
And it essentially gets us nowhere, Your Honor. That language goes in a loop and gets us back to crimes against the spouse, which is what we're arguing here today. I can see that it is an anti-marital act, but not as defined in the appendix to the manual. Because you could define any number of offenses as anti-marital acts, and it was the common law. The common law, as this court stated in McCollum, the common law exception.
They define it here as acts against the spouse and thus the marriage. And so what you're saying is that for other purposes, adultery is an anti-marital act, but under these circumstances, under this definition, it isn't.
Yes, Your Honor, in terms of art, I agree that it's offensive to the marriage, it's offensive to the church, it's offensive to a whole number of things, but it does not meet the definition of the common law.
And your other argument is that this is a crime against good order and discipline and the 134 elements. How do you deal with the discussion under 134 in determining whether it's prejudicial to good order and discipline or of a nature to bring discredit, that one of the things you look at is the negative impact of the conduct on the spouse?
Well, Your Honor, that is one factor that the commands can look at. But ultimately, if the crime or the adultery in this case does not impact good order and discipline, if it does not impugn the reputation of the service,
but it can't be both. It can't be a crime against the property or person of the spouse and also prejudicial to good order and discipline.
Chief Judge Efron, I see that my time has expired.
Let me answer the question.
Your Honor, it can be both. But for it to be a military crime, the spouse does not have to be outraged. And in fact, the outrage to the sensibilities of the spouse is largely irrelevant. It is a factor that can be concluded. But if this happens in a closet and no one finds out except for the wife, it is not a crime under Article 134 because it is not prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discrediting.
But arguably, it's a crime against the spouse. Maybe not prejudicial to good order and discipline.
I would argue it's a humiliation to the spouse, Your Honor, not a crime against the spouse or
okay.
the marriage.
Do you need to argue humiliation when you said it's physical injury or not?
No, Your Honor.
Why are you focusing on humiliation?
Well, Your Honor,
or are you trying to argue that that's the only harm it causes the spouse?
Your Honor, it could certainly. I do not mean to demean Danae Nart's humiliation or the loss that she felt in this case. It is the common law exception is physical harm to the spouse, as distilled through several centuries. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
We have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the Court, I'm Captain James Wyrick, representing the government. The sole issue before this Court today is whether adultery is a crime against the person or property of the spouse for the purposes of MRE 504. The answer to that question is yes, the crime of adultery is a crime against the person of the spouse for the purposes of the husband-wife privilege. As the lower court clearly pointed out, there's no military case law directly on point. We have Renner predating the 1969 manual, and then we have specifically the language in Menchaca where this court finds that there was a determination, an express determination on the part of the drafters to overrule both Renner and Massey when making the 1969 change to the manual. That change included a move from the word injury to the phrase an offense against the person or property of the spouse. The exception, when changed through the MCM, went from an enumeration of offenses to more general language. There were a number of offenses, specific offenses, that were removed from the language, but that was not the spirit to remove them from the exceptions to the privilege. We've just gone to a more general statement of what is not to be included, and that is in line with the common law exceptions. To allow for a more broad reading would be inconsistent with the 1969 drafter's decision, and also as it has been
counsel post MRE.
Yes, sir.
Didn't Congress get involved in this whole matter in the Kelly Flynn case, and didn't the drafters modify the commentary on adultery put in some language basically stating that it was a crime against good order and discipline rather than a crime against marriage or a person?
That is correct, Your Honor. There was some additional commentary put in there. However, just because it has as its terminal element that is an offense against good order and discipline or military or discrediting to the services,
yes,
does not mean that there is also not another more specific injury to an individual. For example, kidnapping or communicating a threat. Both of those fall under Article 134, yet the person kidnapped or the person that the threat is communicated to would clearly also be specifically injured by those crimes.
Well, but that's not this case. They specifically got involved in adultery, and they basically modified the explanatory language on adultery to emphasize that it was a crime against good order and discipline, and it was not that the armed forces weren't in the business of enforcing sexual morality except as it affected good order and discipline or was service discredited. Isn't that the case?
Yes, sir, that is the emphasis of the changes, but it still does not eliminate the possibility of there being a secondary effect. While assuredly the primary effect and the primary rationale for adultery remains good order and discipline or service discrediting, it does not mean that there isn't for the different section for the MRA 504 that there cannot also be a secondary victim. If that answers your question, Ron.
What's the relationship in the rule between paragraph 2A, which talks about persons charged with a crime against the person or property of the other spouse, and 2C, which lists a number of specific offenses? Is there anything in 2C that would not be covered in 2A?
Sir, that would, those covered in 2A, I believe the correct answer to that, Your Honor, is that 2A sets out the entire universe of what would be exceptions. 2C comes in and gives examples as to those certain instances. But does not. So 2C would fit within 2A.
So 2C is unnecessary.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Why should we assume that the President drafted an unnecessary provision? Why isn't it possible to view this as the President's determination that with respect to offenses under Article 133 and 134, there was a need to identify the specific offenses that would be viewed as offenses against the spouse?
Sir, Your Honor, I don't believe it was unnecessary. It was just assistance on the part of the President, because obviously in 2A there are the omissions of numerous offenses. For example, Lady Alderley's rape, is not shown anywhere, but that is assuredly a crime against the spouse.
Crime against the person's spouse. So there'd be no doubt about that, would there?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, going back to the 1969 manual, is it the government's position that everything that was listed in the 1969 manual is incorporated in the present rules of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about polygamy? Why is polygamy an offense against the spouse if you have a situation in which a spouse is willingly entered into the arrangement? We have well-known situations of polygamy in the country that are tolerated by civil authorities. Why would that become an offense against the spouse?
Your Honor, the government did not prepare for that argument. We limited our argument only to adultery.
The government did argue that the manual provisions were incorporated.
That's correct.
And I'm trying to figure out whether that's actually the case, whether polygamy was incorporated. What about forgery? Forging the name of the spouse. The manual in 1969 made that an automatic crime. Automatic exception if it would apparently operate to the prejudice of the other. Didn't even have to be a crime against the other person at that point. It only had to apparently operate as to the prejudice.
Your Honor, I believe the apparently was because if the forged document was not actually used or did not ultimately. So it was more of that making it attempt language, but any forgery of a document that would work to the detriment of a spouse is clearly an injury to the property of the spouse.
But if it was only apparently, then it wouldn't. What I'm trying to get at is, do we have a literal incorporation of every word that's in the 1969 manual, or just a conceptual incorporation?
I believe the conceptual incorporation, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And that's the reason for moving away from specifics.
Could someone be charged with adultery under the code if the other their spouse knew and acquiesced in the adultery?
Yes, Your Honor, because that could, as the court has pointed out, that could still be injurious to good order and discipline or service discrediting. We would not depend on the actual feelings of the other spouse.
So in that instance, would it be a crime against the person of the spouse?
Yes, Your Honor, and the government's position is that it would be.
In what way?
In that it was injurious to the marriage.
But the other spouse is acquiesced.
Yes, Your Honor, there are certain crimes where one could acquiesce, yet there still be a crime. The state has the ability to prosecute, for example, assault or batteries that one could consent to, yet they would still be criminal in nature.
Would it be against the spouse, or would it just be an anti-marital act? I mean, I understand your argument, and I'm just trying to test the boundary of where it takes us.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that boundary, if this court were to adopt a test where the individual spouse would dictate that boundary could almost be limitless. There could be one spouse at any one time that could consent to anything, making almost nothing a crime against the spouse. Any horrible act against that spouse, as long as they were consenting to it and didn't feel offended by it, Your Honor, then that would take it out of the realm of being a crime against the spouse. It would appear that the better test would be an objective test that determined per se this would be an offense against the spouse. Then you don't have the personal or individual feelings on a case-by-case basis, Your Honor.
You earlier said that you were talking about a crime against the spouse in regard to adultery. Does the spouse have a property interest in a marriage? Do we ignore the property aspect of that phrase?
Your Honor, of course, this court is able to view it either as property, personal or property dispute. It would seem that although it could be an injury, yes, a spouse does have a property interest in a marriage. However, that would probably be most clearly protected under state law and division of said property at dissolution of marriage, not necessarily a criminal injury to the property.
Well, it seems that you're relying on a crime to a person and limiting that to the spouse. And I'm just wondering, if in fact there is a property interest in a marriage, that the crime against the property in this situation goes to the interest of the marital interest, rather than a crime against the spouse individually, the person of the spouse.
Fisher, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question, that the marriage in and of itself is an entity such
as the quote anti-marital aspects.
Yes, sir, the government would not be in opposition to that view, that the marriage in and of itself is an intangible object that each spouse has a certain property interest in the continued validity of that marriage.
Well, prior to the Married Women's Property Acts, wasn't adultery a crime against the husband's property and his wife?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll continue further, and as the lower court in Taylor mentions, that, Your Honor, as you just mentioned, we have to go back quite a while in time to find state or federal case law on this issue. But when we do come across those cases, that it is shown that adultery is an offense against the state of marriage, thus against the other spouse. Overall, this is a policy determination. It's not constitutional in nature, and there are the two competing policies, as this court of course knows, between the public interest in getting the most evidence before a court, before the decision maker must make a decision. On the other hand, we have privileges, which allow...
I'm sorry, are you asking us to make a policy call on this? Is that what you said? In the ultimate analysis, is a policy question?
But no, Your Honor, I'm just giving some background on this issue, and it would seem that there's not the necessity for a policy determination, Your Honor, because that policy determination has been made by the President.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Thank you.
So, in the overall, there are the need for all the facts before the fact finder, and then the privilege of the marriage. We believe that this, the crime of adultery, is a crime against the person of the spouse in order to take it out of the marriage, because it is an abandonment of the spouse who engages in adultery has abandoned the marriage now, and therefore to use the marriage as a shield in the criminal context does not seem correct.
I have a question that you may be able to help me with, is what's the precedential value of the discussion section to the Military Rules of Evidence? Do you know?
It similar to legislative history, Your Honor, that it gives explanation to any portion of the manual that would not be, that is not clear.
But it itself is not a decision by the President as to what the policy decision should be in this case. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if the more natural reading of the plain language of the Military Rule of Evidence that we actually have is person or property of the spouse, why can't the President amend the rule to say, and also anti-marital offenses?
Your Honor, the short question is the President is free to do that. However, it's unnecessary because in this sense, Your Honor, if the President was to amend it to include crimes that are anti-marital, and then we would always still have a discussion section, and then we have the circular problem of if this question is before this court again, there's something in the discussion, why wasn't that incorporated into the manual itself? And then we go back to the 1951 version of the manual that gave either an illustrative or an exhaustive list of those crimes that that are crimes for the purposes of the exception.
Thank you.
It seemed kind of strange if the rewriting took place that the President wouldn't at a minimum decide which of those aspects of the 1969 manual would be included expressly, wouldn't it? That was your suggestion that we might be into an infinite series of interpretations here. In one sense, that's always true. Creative activities of members of the armed forces and their counsel will always give us new situations to interpret. But as to the recurring items, why should it be so difficult for the president to set forth those things that were in the 1969 manual if the president believes that that's where the exception should apply?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that is because of the problems we saw previously when there were enumerated crimes, that then if there was an omission, then that may not have been a purposeful omission. It gave more difficulty to the practitioners in this court. We're going to plain language, which is what the government's also relying on, the plain language of crimes against the person of the spouse took away that problem of specific crimes being enumerated or the failure of their mention in there, meaning there without the privilege, when that could lead to absurd results because the 51 manual did not even mention rape, which would clearly qualify.
This case had been litigated in a federal district court. How would it have been resolved?
So that's a bit difficult to say.
We're looking at Article 36, one of the aspects of Article 36 says that the president will apply the rules exist in the rules of evidence in the federal district courts, except that where the president determines those to be contrary to or inconsistent with the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Yes, sir. I mean, the government definitely agrees with that position. The difficulty is just finding that situation having taken place.
Is adultery a crime in the civilian sector?
So I couldn't actually speak to every jurisdiction.
Is it under Title 18? Let's say a federal, is adultery a federal crime in civil jurisdictions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Federal crime or a state crime?
A state crime, Your Honor. So, of course, the federal court would apply to the extent that it is substantive, the state law, as to that privilege.
So that means in federal court, it depends on what? The site of the marriage? The site of the incident? Side of the trial?
I'm not sure under a conflicts of law analysis, Your Honor, which when that would come into play, but obviously that would depend. Again, where the government's hampered in that answering that question just because of the lack of cases on there, or at least reported cases, Your Honor.
But if we look at Article 36, which tells the president that the president should be applying the rules that are generally recognized in the United States District Court, and they can't be contrary to or inconsistent with this chapter, and the president decides that we're going to have rules of privilege, and if those rules of privilege are different from the rules that are applied in the federal district courts, and a number of them are, shouldn't we construe those rules very narrowly and expressly in light of Article 36 to say, if the president wants to depart from what's going on in the federal district courts, we haven't established whether the president has or has not done that, but let's assume that the president has. If the president wants to depart from what's going on in the federal district courts, the president needs to be very express about that. And that we find that throughout Section 5 of the Rules of Evidence, that the president has said, here are some express things that I want to make sure either do or do not get into courts martial. So here, why shouldn't we require either a demonstration either that this is consistent with the manner in which the case would be litigated in a federal district court, or if not, that involves something that the president has expressly said, I'm taking this off the table.
Your Honor, I believe that under Article 36, it's to the extent the president considers it practicable to keep the rules of evidence in line with the other federal courts. I believe that there are some instances, and this being one of them, where that's generally not possible to do, because as discussed earlier in today's argument, the American Bar Association and Congress, when looking at the case of adultery prior to 2002, determined that it is almost exclusively a military, a crime against good order and discipline in the military, so that there will not be a growth or expansion or even elaboration upon the civilian rules of evidence for the husband-wife privilege as it relates to the case of adultery, because it's no longer a crime. This is a specific military crime. Therefore, this would be one of the exceptions where the president could carve out and say, this is where the military rule of evidence could differ from federal practice because the crime differs from federal practice, Your Honor.
That would be the rationale for sustaining a presidential decision on adultery as an exception here, or as without the exception. So my question is, in light of Article 36, why shouldn't we require the president to be express? That is, we're not dealing with a parade of possible interpretive matters. We'd say, Mr. President, if you have matters which are not going to be litigated in the federal district courts in a manner that allows us to determine what the rules of evidence are there, and you want them to either provide an exception to a privilege or to provide a privilege, you've got to state what it is.
Yes, Your Honor, this court is free to do that. It's our position that the president has done that by giving broad language in the exception section under 504.
Okay, thank you.
Would abandonment or failure to support be a crime against the person or property of the spouse?
Yes, Your Honor. Because that would be definitely a crime against the property interest of the spouse, depending on where they're residing at the time. If it were at a community property jurisdiction, then failure to allow the other spouse access to that community property would definitely be a crime against the property interest of the spouse. And so, the governor requests that this court find that the crime of adultery is a crime against the person of the spouse for the purposes of MRE 504. If, in the alternative, this court finds that it was error to allow the wife's testimony in the lower court, that any error was harmless, and we ask that this court confirm the findings and sentence of the lower court. If there are no further questions, this ends the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
As the government noted, the language between the 1969 manual did in fact change. The 1969 manual provided an exception whenever the spouse was injured, that broad definition, and then proceeded to list a number of separate offenses. The manual for court martial, the military rules of evidence that were amended in 1980, changed that language to crime against the person. And there is, in fact, Judge Ryan, a difference between a crime against the person and a crime against the spouse. The crime against the person is a call back to the common law. That is the language in Stein v. Bowman. That is the language in Bassett, a crime against the person. And so when the manual was amended in 1980, forgery,
is removed, abandonment is removed, adultery is removed, bigamy, polygamy, all of these offenses, and what the president expressly intends to keep is, in fact, what is in the manual presently. Footnote 6 of United States versus McCollum, this court stated that this court should adopt rules of privilege and exceptions that are as clear to the layperson as they are to the lawyer in a system of justice, integrally incorporating both. The rule, as it's drafted and given its plain meaning, does in fact do that. I just want to spend just a brief moment addressing the government's argument that if they are incorrect, or if they are incorrect on the law, that in fact this privilege does not incorporate this, that this error was harmless. An application of the four Kerr factors decided in 1999 indicates that this error is not in fact harmless. We're dealing with evidence that is material and also that weighs against harmless error. As the Supreme Court said in Arizona versus Fulminati, a defendant's own confession is the most damning sort of evidence against him. And that's what you have at issue in this case, is appellant's confession through his wife coming in before the finder of fact. And if you ultimately weigh the strength of the government and defense case, you need you come to the conclusion that this error was not in fact harmless. And for an example of that, you need to look no further than page 284 of the record, when the military judge announces findings. Because AM in this case testifies regarding all three of the offenses, the sodomy, adultery, and also carnal knowledge. Appellant's spouse testifies only to the first two, that being unlawful sexual intercourse with AM. The military judge acquits appellant on AM's testimony alone with regard to the sodomy charge. And that's not surprising, because she can't recall when she says on page 145 in a previous statement that she had told the agents, NCIS agents, when they were addressing this story when it first came out, that sodomy had happened 6 or 7 times with appellant. She changes her story at trial, and at that point it happens only once. And so the military judge on page 284 sending this court the signal that he did not believe the appellant. And ultimately what comes down, this case comes down to a credibility contest between AM, who is entirely incredible, and an outstanding Marine in Sergeant Taylor. For instance, Gunnery Sergeant Eric Brown on page 81 testifies that appellant is a truthful person. On page 81, that he is a law-abiding person. On page 82, that he, quote, is an outstanding sergeant and an outstanding combat engineer. You see in Defense Exhibit Alpha, which is a stipulation of Jeremy Westerbrook, AM's next-door neighbor, that she is, in fact, an untruthful person. She has a reputation for untruthfulness. Again, bolstering appellant's credibility, this good military character defense. First Sergeant William Small on page 245, that Sergeant Taylor is a truthful person. 245, Sergeant Taylor is a law-abiding Marine. 246, outstanding military character. First Lieutenant Vaughn Svengensen on page 249, appellant's platoon leader, a truthful Marine. 249, a law-abiding citizen. And on page 250, an outstanding Marine. And finally, Sergeant Andre Alcar, who was with appellant the night of one of these alleged incidents, on page 256, that he's a law-abiding person. On page 256, he is an excellent Marine. And on page 255, he is a truthful person. And so when you get into all of that, the United States offered no rebuttal whatsoever to appellant's outstanding military character. And so if this court reaches the issue of whether or not this error was harmless, it cannot be found to be harmless, because examining the defense cases, the materiality of the evidence indicates that this was harmful. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will stand in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock this morning.
I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
It's granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. At issue in this case is how much information does a military judge need to have in front of him when faced with an issue of the mental competency of the defendant before he is required to reopen the providency inquiry. Appellant's position is that he created a substantial basis in both law and fact, which was unrebutted,
for the military judge to reopen the province inquiry. Unfortunately, the military judge did not.
Is that the standard we're looking at, substantial basis in law and fact, or is that just what you think they've achieved here?
It would be the standard is abuse of discretion, Your Honor, and it would be the Prater standard, Your Honor.
Major Sanchez, you were counsel before the lower court, weren't you?
Not fully, Your Honor. I was counsel at the rebuttals, at the reply stage, Your Honor.
Okay, but you're listed as counsel, but you're saying you were just counsel at the reply stage?
Yes, Your Honor. I didn't write the initial brief in this case.
Because a question that I had in my mind is if it was so clear that the military judge should have seen that there was a substantial basis in law and fact, why wasn't this issue raised in the lower court?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue was not raised with the lower court. The initial appellate defense counsel raised the issue using the same factual scenario, but within the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. When the issue was decided and I was required to write the supplemental brief, I spotted that issue, and that's when it was raised, Your Honor.
Could you expand on that, how the issue arose in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Initially, right before the trial, during an 802 session, the appellate defense counsel apparently stated to the military judge that there were military records that were asked for but had not arrived by the date of trial. It appears that the defense decided to go forward without reviewing the medical records. And that was in part the reason why the ineffective assistance of counsel was raised, that the medical records were not reviewed by the defense counsel. If he had reviewed them, perhaps he would have been able to formulate a possible defense in this case. He did not, and he allowed the opponent to plead guilty without the advice that he could have been given.
What precisely does the military judge's recitation of the 802 session tell us?
It tells us, Your Honor, that there was an issue with the medical records and that...
What was the issue?
That they had not arrived, Your Honor. And apparently they were going to be used for extenuation mitigation.
What I'd ask is you describe specifically what was in the 802 session and not the apparently. Your interpretation of it, because the rule for court-martial requires a military judge to place on the record what transpired in an 802 session.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm reading from the record at page 13, where the military judge states, an issue regarding potential E&M evidence requested by the defense, the medical records of the accused, and did not have it arrived yet, and what will we do about that?
So all we have on the record is medical. Nothing in the defense presentation in the 802, at least as reflected in the record, suggested to the military judge at that point, did it, that there would be any defense raised by those records?
No, Your Honor, that would be a correct statement. The military judge could not have known just based on that information itself, especially since it was characterizing the evidence.
Well, what do you want the judge to do here? What is he supposed to do? The defense has a burden of proving lack of mental responsibility by clear and convincing evidence. Here you have an 802 that you've just admitted says nothing, and then you've got the unsworn statement of the accused in sentencing averring that he has bipolar disorder, and of course an unsworn statement by definition isn't evidence. What's the quantum necessary to trigger a requirement that the judge reopen again? He got through the CARE inquiry. Is his assertion as a layman that there's something wrong with him in an unsworn statement enough to raise the issue, enough to undercut a guilty plea when he gets through the CARE inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor. First, the lower court in its findings stated as follows. The appellant clearly articulated the severity of his injuries during his unsworn statement. Trial defense counsel further questioned the appellant to elicit even more painstakingly detail about the attack and its influence on the appellant. These are the findings of the lower court that essentially goes on to say that
Well, yes, the lower court found he'd been beaten with a lead pipe. But that's not the same thing as finding that he didn't lack metal, that he lacked mental responsibility.
Well, the key word in that finding, Your Honor, is the influence, that the military judge was aware of the influence to the appellant. In United States versus Jennings, this court stated that when the appellant makes statements like this, that the military judge needs to take those statements at face value. And this court used those two words, face value.
Oh, he said, are you saying that we require that we're supposed to take a layman's self-diagnosis at face value on an issue of mental responsibility?
Well, Your Honor, now we know that it wasn't a self-diagnosis.
Oh, but we didn't know, the judge didn't know that.
The judge, Your Honor, knew that if we take the appellant's statement at face value, the judge knew that the appellant had gone through a traumatic ordeal. He knew that there were medical records out there for extenuation and mitigation. Now, whereas perhaps that 802 session didn't really create anything, now we can marry both of these circumstances up. The 802 session and the unsworn statement.
Well, doesn't that shove us right back into ineffective assistance of counsel?
The ineffective assistance of counsel analysis, Your Honor, is a higher standard than the abuse of discretion.
But what I'm saying is the judge knew there were medical records out there because it was averred that there were such. Counsel chose to proceed. He made a tactical decision to proceed. His client got through the CARE inquiry. What do you want the judge to do here?
Your Honor, the appellant's position is that when a judge is faced with information the appellant has a bipolar condition, to simply reopen the providency.
No, he's not faced with information. He's faced with the appellant's unsworn assertion that he has a bipolar condition.
Nevertheless, Your Honor, that has in the past been enough to reopen the providency inquiry.
Thank you.
Go
ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In United States versus Sims, the Army Court was faced with similar circumstances. And it was also made during an unsworn statement.
But in United States versus Sims, there's two components to a lack of mental responsibility defense, aren't there? I mean, it's not enough that someone have a severe mental disease or defect. I'm correct about that, right? They also have to have been unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of the act. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't it a fact that in the Sims case, the person suggested that he didn't know why he'd done it and that he'd heard voices and that he had a friend that no one else knew about? Isn't that rather different than the facts in this case, where even today, the appellant has not suggested that he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his acts?
Yes, Your Honor. In Sims, admittedly, there was more information presented by the appellant. And in this case, there was less. However, it goes back to it being whether it's enough. And in this case, the appellant clearly stated that it was after this beating that he received that he began to get into trouble, and admittedly, the more serious trouble than he had ever gotten into before.
But did he ever say that he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his acts? I mean, what substantial evidence of that factor, of that prong of the lack of mental responsibility defense, did the military judge have?
He didn't state that, Your Honor, and that goes to the abuse of discretion. He didn't state it because the military judge should have asked him that question. He should have resumed his inquiry or reopened his providency in order to be certain that the appellant really was guilty and really didn't have these defenses.
Well, I understand that that's your position, and I also understand that maybe in a perfect world that would have been, we wouldn't be here with this argument if that had happened, but that's not the test. The test is whether he abused his discretion, whether there was substantial evidence of the second prong that he should have opened the inquiry, that there was a defense there.
And no, Your Honor, the appellant did not meet that second part of the inquiry. And it was mainly because it was an unsworn statement. He was trying to present it as extenuation and mitigation. He wasn't trying to present
he wasn't trying to disrupt his guilty plea. And it's evident from the record that the appellant really didn't want to plead guilty at that point. But what we don't know is, well, was he bipolar? Did this bipolar condition really affect him at the time?
Even assuming that he's bipolar, I'm suggesting that he could have been bipolar, and that by itself doesn't raise the defense. And I'm suggesting that even in his statement, which is that we have today, he doesn't suggest that he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his acts because of the bipolar disease or because he was hit in the head.
We don't have that information, Your Honor. No, from his statement, all he said was that he was diagnosed with bipolar syndrome. And the appellant's position is that would have been enough. That should have been enough for the military judge to at least make the inquiry.
So could I ask, are you saying there on this record there is some evidence raising a possible defense, or are you saying this is really a care inquiry issue, that this demonstrates an improper care inquiry?
The appellant's position is that there is some evidence of raising a possible defense, Your Honor.
Right now, on this record?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant specifically tied his bipolar condition to the offenses.
So if this had been, say, before members, then there should have been an instruction given on the affirmative defense based on this alone?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't go that far.
So it's not clear to me whether you're saying the essential error is that there was some evidence raised, or that the error was in light of the fact that there's something that less than that, the judge had a care requirement to proceed further before determining whether there was some evidence raised.
Your Honor, if it was in front of members, the appellant's burden would have been by clear and convincing. It would have been a clear and convincing evidence. Clearly, he wasn't trying to meet that burden when he made these statements. So, no, if it was in front of members, this would not have been enough. However, this was a preliminary statement which the military judge should have taken further. And we don't know whether or not the military judge would have been able to salvage the problem, see, or whether the military judge would have at that point stated, you know what, that's what we're showing, you need to go to 706, or I'm going to enter not guilty pleas in your case.
What standard does this meet, this evidence, his statement? You're saying that is X. What's X here?
Substantial basis, Your Honor. It creates a substantial basis of both law and fact that there's reason to question the providence of the inquiry.
Are you saying that his assertion of a medical fact in an unsworn statement is enough to create a basis for questioning it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. It negates the providence of the inquiry.
Okay.
And regardless of what happened before during the providence of the inquiry, he may have sounded okay to the military judge, but as soon as he states, I'm bipolar, and that bipolar condition influenced my actions, my subsequent criminal actions.
He didn't say that. He said post hoc ergo propter hoc.
Yes,
he said, I'm a bipolar, and I got into trouble.
I'll reward him, Your Honor. He tied the bipolar condition to his offenses. And by tying the bipolar condition to the offenses, it negates the entire providence inquiry.
And that is the quantum necessary to raise the question. In other words, in any case in which mental responsibility may be an issue, the accused's unsworn assertion of a medical fact is enough.
We don't have a hard answer to that, a hard and fast answer to that question, Your Honor, just because this court has not dealt with that issue. We know that the Navy and Marine Corps court did deal with it and set aside the finding, one particular finding that affected that issue, and we know that the Army dealt with the issue with the same result. In fact,
Sims.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
In Sims,
Your Honor.
Right. As Judge Ryan pointed out, there's substantially more in the record than Sims.
Yes, Your Honor. But there is a difference in Sims also in the remedy that the court granted. The court didn't just say, well, he needed to reopen the providence inquiry, which is actually what appellant is asking this court to find.
The court in Sims stated military judge needed to go further. He needed to actually order 7-6, which is different from Herald, where the Native Marine Corps court said the province inquiry would be enough, or even actually asking the defense counsel.
Well, counsel, let's follow up on the 7-6. Government has suggested as an alternative here, they're not requesting that we do this, but as an alternative, that this court order a 7-6 board. Why should we do any more than that? That is, if the error in the judge was not ordering the 7-6 board, why shouldn't we then order the 7-6 board? After all, the 7-6 board could come back and say, no problem. In this case, the individual met all the standards in terms of mental competence and mental responsibility, and therefore there was no defense. If that were the result of a 7-6 board, there'd be no need for us to set a fines and sentence. So why shouldn't that be the most that we do in this case?
Your Honor, it's because this case involves a providency inquiry, so it negates the inquiry itself. So what this court, what the appellant is asking this court to do is set aside the fines and sentence and have the government do it all over again.
Major Sanchez, there's a presumption in the law that the accused is mentally competent, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's also the state of the law in this court that for the military judge to have abused his discretion in accepting a guilty plea, that he needed to have a substantial basis in law or fact for rejecting the guilty plea, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I'm looping back to my first question. What evidence did the military judge have that gave him a substantial basis for believing that this accused was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his acts?
Well, Your Honor, he knew that a bipolar condition creates a defense.
And that's one prong of the defense. What evidence did he have that met the other prong of the defense?
Yes, Your Honor. As there was a tie-in between the bipolar condition and the offenses that the appellant made in his own sworn statement.
There's a temporal coincidence. I mean, that's all we have in the record.
The appellant would disagree with that characterization, Your Honor. The appellant's position is that that was not a coincidence. He specifically tied it, and now he supported it not just with the medical records, but also with his own affidavit, specifically tying his offenses to the bipolar condition.
Leaving aside the sentencing portion of the case, you would agree that the appellant in this case, that his care inquiry, that he was provident to the charges that were there against him. Leaving aside the sentencing, that his answer, that the military judge correctly went through the elements of the offenses and that the accused was provident with respect to those elements.
Yes, Your Honor, the appellant would agree with that. But for his unsworn statement, there wouldn't have been a problem with the privacy inquiry.
Is there something particular about his statement that he was bipolar that in its own right triggers this? If he had said post-traumatic stress disorder or schizophrenia?
No, Your Honor.
Are you focusing, is there some study you're aware of that says bipolar people can't control themselves in all circumstances? Or I'm trying to figure out whether you think the rule is that you're trying to espouse is one of mental illness of some sort or injury of some sort, or whether you're really, the focus here is on bipolar and there's something magic about that or significantly severe about it that should alert any military judge when the word bipolar comes up that you're in a new game.
Your Honor, the appellant is focusing on bipolar just because that's what he was diagnosed with, and that's what he presented also to the military judge. The defense at the lower level also raised the issue of traumatic brain injury, and that could have been also an effect that created these, that caused him to commit these offenses, to commit himself the way he did. But no, it could be almost any serious mental defect, Your Honor. It could be post-traumatic stress disorder, which is perhaps more common nowadays than bipolar disorder. But there is a case by this court that specifically mentions bipolar disorder in United States versus Harris. In Harris, however, the military judge did make a finding that there was a bipolar disorder. However, he did not go forward with reopening the competency inquiry.
Counsel, I'm trying to figure out precisely what the military judge should have done. Let's assume that when the judge hears words like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress syndrome, etc., that's an alert. So the judge hears those words. What does the judge do next? Does he immediately order a 706 board, or does the judge make an inquiry as to counsel as to whether there's a defense on the issue of mental responsibility? There's evidence of defense. What does the judge do at that point?
Perhaps the first step, Your Honor, is to ask the appellant what he is he tying this bipolar condition to his offenses.
Okay, and if the accused says no, what happens then?
The military judge should ask the appellate the trial defense counsel whether or not he agrees and whether or not he has researched the issue.
And if the defense counsel says yes, we're not offering a defense here, I understand the law, what happens then?
That should satisfy the military judge, Your Honor, unless there's some other reason for him not to be satisfied.
Okay, then I'm trying to figure out the implications of that for the present situation. We have the magic words having been said at trial, bipolar disorder. So we're all in the first stage of an issue being identified as to potential defense of mental responsibility. I have not seen anything either in the record or the submissions of the defense in which the defense is taking the position, either from the point of view of the appellant or appellate defense counsel, that there is a defense of mental responsibility in this case. And who should know better whether there is than the appellant, or if the appellant is mentally impaired, the appellant's counsel, as to whether that defense exists? So on what basis would we even order a 706 board in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, the trial defense counsel did not create the issue at all. He didn't address the issue other than addressing it at the 802 session. Just because the trial defense counsel didn't address the issue doesn't mean that the issue wasn't there. For Strickland, the appellant unfortunately just rates a D-minus defense counsel. It's not necessarily an A-plus defense counsel. And just because, and the standard shouldn't be, well, was he an A-plus defense counsel? And apparently he was not. We raised his IAC during the lower level. Whether or not he was D-minus, that's up to this court to determine. But definitely the issue was not raised. The issue is now raised on appeal. And the appellant has presented his affidavit to that effect, that the offenses are tied to the bipolar condition. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
So you're relying then on the submissions by the defense now that he lacked mental responsibility?
Yes, Your Honor.
To be clear, what is your strongest argument? You've given us a number of options, perhaps hoping that we'll bite on one of them, in terms of a range of errors the military judge may have made, including failure to ask another question, failure to find that there's a substantial basis to reject the plea on immediately at the time, and failure to order a 706 board. Which is your strongest argument, and what do you hope we run with?
What the appellant hopes that this court decides in the end is that it set aside the findings in the sentence because the military judge should have reopened the competency inquiry. That's the simplest solution to this issue. And that's the only thing that the appellant would have asked, that the military judge had reopened the competency inquiry. He would have had a complete record had he done that.
So notwithstanding you're throwing a number of balls in the air, are you saying fundamentally the error here is one of the care inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm asking and not telling. I just want to make sure I'm focusing on what you think your strongest argument is.
The appellant would agree, Your Honor, that our strongest argument is actually the simplest one, and that is that the military judge should have reopened the competency inquiry.
This court could, of course, add, as Chief Judge Efron stated, the additional question to the defense counsel, which is certainly reasonable considering that the appellant might be bipolar and might be answering questions in an offshot way. And finally, that the military judge, if he thinks that he's not satisfied with the issue, he should order a 706 inquiry. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Counsel, in your brief, you did not tie, I didn't see the tie to appellant's affidavit as the basis for ordering a 706 board now, because you weren't focusing on that. That is, however, one of the issues that the government has raised. What specifically would you like us to look at to say that the accused is now identified specifically that he lacked mental responsibility at the time of the offense?
Your Honor, in his affidavit, the appellant states that he believes that his bipolar condition caused the offenses that he committed. And I apologize to this court, I don't have the exact quote from the appellant's affidavit.
You're referring to, I came back and that's when I started to get in trouble?
That would be on the record, Your Honor, yes. And that would be on page 50 of the record. However, the appellant also repeats it in his affidavit.
You might want to take a look at that during your opportunity for rebuttal, because if there, I think that one of the questions here is, if there's a requirement for a 706 board, it would be because the appellant has alleged a lack of mental responsibility. An appellant and an appellant counsel who don't allege a lack of mental responsibility, I think there's a serious question as to whether there'd be a basis for this court to order a board.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If appellant or appellant defense counsel have not alleged that the individual lacked mental responsibility or that there's a substantial issue as to whether there was a lack of mental responsibility, then I think there would be a significant question as to whether there would be a basis for us to order a board in this case. An individual said, I had a mental defect, but who doesn't come in and specifically tie that defect to the offense, doesn't necessarily raise the requirement that there be a board.
No, Your Honor, the appellant would disagree with that. The appellant's position is that there is enough on the record that had the lower court in conducting its, and I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I may finish arguing your question. Had the lower court in conducting its Article 66C review read through the unsworn statement and thought about that issue, that it would have been enough by itself to have raised the issue.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. I'm Captain Jeff Shields, and I represent the United States. The single issue before this court this morning is whether the military judge abused his discretion in accepting appellant's guilty pleas. In the review of a guilty plea for an abuse of discretion, this court looks to the record of trial to determine if there is a substantial basis in law and fact for disturbing that plea. In such a review, the military judge's decisions are to be evaluated based solely on what was known to him at trial. In this record of trial, there is no indication that there is a substantial basis in law and fact for disturbing this plea. In challenging his guilty plea, appellant relies exclusively on a single unsupported utterance buried in his unsworn statement. This passing reference to a medical condition is not enough to disturb an otherwise overwhelmingly provident guilty plea.
Can you distinguish this case from the Harris case that was recently decided by the court?
Yes, ma'am, absolutely. In the Harris case, what the military judge had before him were specific findings
by a clinical psychiatrist that appellant was suffering bipolar syndrome and was not able to understand the quality and wrongfulness of his actions. This set of circumstances was not present in this case. There was no diagnosis before the military judge, and there was certainly no indication by a psychiatrist that appellant could not understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions, Your Honor.
Well, can I ask a legal policy question? And I'm acknowledging it's a legal policy question and then a legal question. Would it, in the context of military today, is it prudent for military judges to follow up on such statements addressing, implicating post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar, or whatever? I'm being very clear, this is a legal policy question, not a law question at this time.
Oh, yes, Your Honor, absolutely. Given the fact that there are many service members who come back from overseas with post-traumatic stress disorder and things of such, it would be prudent policy-wise for military judges to inquire into any such leads at a court-martial. That's correct, Your Honor, from a policy standpoint.
Okay. As a matter of law, why is that or is that not required as a matter of care?
As a matter of care, Your Honor?
Care of the case and care in how you undertake providence inquiries.
Well, because, Your Honor, this is... Well, the standard before us today is abuse of discretion, so we must determine if the military judge erred by accepting this plea based on what he knew at the time of trial. And given the facts before the military judge has established from the Providence inquiry and from the other statements in the unsworn statement, it is clear that all facts negated the potential for a defense of mental responsibility based on what appellant said regarding bipolar disorder.
What in the government's view are the facts that are relevant and known to the judge at the time? The appellant is obviously focusing on page 50, featuring page 50. Is that the sum total of the facts, or what other facts does the government think are relevant in determining whether due care was taken in this case?
Well, the dialogue between the military judge and appellant, Your Honor, contained in the Providence inquiry is important and relevant to establish that the appellant did indeed understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions, and he did indeed accept responsibility for his actions. However, page 49 and 50 of the record of trial containing appellant's unsworn statement is also relevant, both because it contains the bipolar statement, but also because it also just illustrates that the appellant understood the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions. So they're both equally important, Your Honor.
What language in particular do you draw our attention to? You've indicated that the Providence dialogue is one factual box and the second is the sentencing statement, but what in particular? I understand you can say totality, but would you... I'm looking for your specific argument.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the unsworn statement on sentencing, appellant clearly indicates that he was able to understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness actions, and it's clear here with respect to the adultery charge, where appellant states in the statement, record of trial, page 50, I did know that Jessica Sigler was married, but I was under the impression that it was a contract marriage just for money at first. After I found out that it wasn't, I changed the relationship. That statement alone, Your Honor, illustrates he understood that the relationship was wrong. Otherwise, there was no need to change the relationship as soon as he found out that it was a legitimate marriage.
Does Harris stand for the proposition that a person who has a bipolar disorder sometimes understands and sometimes doesn't with respect to the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of the act?
I would not say that Harris stands for that proposition, Your Honor. Harris...
Why would we have determined what we did in Harris' case if that wasn't the case?
Well, the significance of Harris isn't the fact that it is bipolar per se, Your Honor. The significance is what was before the military judge, where he had specific findings of a mental deficiency and findings that he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of his actions. It's not the fact that it was bipolar in and of itself, Your Honor.
Wasn't there a pretrial sanity board in Harris that said he was all right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Isn't this case a fortiori from Harris? And Harris, the judge had before him the findings of a pretrial sanity board saying, this guy's okay. He also had some evidence from a psychologist saying this guy's not okay. But in Harris, he had a sanity board saying this guy's okay, and we still required a new trial. In this case, a fortiori from Harris?
Yes, Your Honor, and actually in Harris,
a fortiori against, which way does the sword of justice cut?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
Well, I'm saying if in Harris we required a new trial, and the judge had before him the findings of a sanity board saying this guy's okay, and we still required a new trial, why ought we not to do it in this case where the situation is a lot murkier?
Yes, Your Honor, because in Harris, the military judge had before him the results of a post-trial sanity hearing, was specifically stated by a clinical psychiatrist that appellant was suffering from a mental deficiency, bipolar in that situation, and he was not able to understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his acts. After that, the convening authority, Your Honor, ordered a 39-day session based on the conflicting psychiatry reports. And the military judge listened to testimony based on both psychiatrists among other individuals, but those are the two main ones. And based on listening to these two conflicting reports, he went ahead and decided, based on that, that the appellant did suffer from bipolar disorder. However, he was able to understand the quality of the wrongfulness of his actions. And this court held that he was wrong because he did not reopen providency and give appellant the opportunity to plead that, to potentially use that defense in that situation, because he made that decision and the appellant did not know that these findings were there, and pled guilty without the knowledge that there were specific findings that he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions, Your Honor.
And was it those additional findings that provided the substantial basis in law or fact that should have put the military judge on notice that he should reopen the providency inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor.
That would be defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Getting back to my earlier question, then doesn't Harris stand for the proposition that there can be circumstances in which bipolar means that a person does not appreciate the quality and wrongfulness of the acts? That's why this court wanted to create or ordered the creation of the opportunity for contesting that at trial, so that the defense would have the opportunity to prove that, not necessarily that it was in fact the case that Harris lacked that mental responsibility at the time. We didn't conclude that, but didn't we conclude that he should have the opportunity to prove that based upon the bipolar diagnosis?
Yes, Your Honor, there are cases that establish that.
Okay, so why doesn't that apply here when the words bipolar are spoken at the trial? Why doesn't that put the military judge in the position of making sure that this person does not have a mental disease or defect that puts him in that category of not being able to appreciate the responsibility for the act at the time that it was committed? The fact that he can articulate at trial doesn't answer, particularly in the context of a bipolar situation, doesn't answer the question of whether he did or did not lack mental responsibility at the time of the offense.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So how did this judge know that this individual was not suffering from a bipolar disease at the time of the offense, such that he lacked mental responsibility at that time, regardless of his coherence at another time?
It was based on the answers given in the care inquiry, sir, during the providence, where appellant, his answers, his acknowledgement of the wrongfulness of his actions, his candor in his answers and admissions of guilt, his depth of memory and recollection of the offenses in question, and the dates and all the events surrounding the evenings of the offenses in question illustrate that he was of sound mind and was able to understand at the time in question. Further, Your Honor, throughout the record of trial, there are instances where the word appellant indicates that he does understand that his actions were wrong, and he did understand that his actions were wrong at the time he committed the offenses. Now, Your Honor, with respect to this causal link, appellant wants the court to find that the military judge was essentially asleep at the switch and missing this causal link. In his brief, page 4, appellant asserts, upon hearing that appellant suffered from a bipolar condition and that appellant correlated the condition with the charged offenses, the military judge should have advised appellant that he had an affirmative defense. So now I'm making this a question, did the military judge err by not making this correlation? I would like to read an excerpt from the unsworn statement, starting at page 49, going to page 50. And I understand the court has heard the statement, but it's important that this court hears exactly what the military judge heard and the context in which he heard it. So this is excerpt from the unsworn statement, page 49. On the 20th of November, 2001, I was jumped outside of the waffle shop out in town and robbed. I was hit in the head repeatedly with a lead pipe. I suffered 2 skull fractures, bruising and bleeding in the brain. I woke up several days later out of a coma to find out that I am completely deaf in my left ear and partially blind in my left eye. I was hospitalized for about a month. Upon returning to my unit from the hospital, I went to see the division psychiatrist who was diagnosed with bipolar syndrome because of the incident. After that, I was denied convalescent leave and only given 8 days annual leave for Christmas.
Now, keep reading.
Yes.
I came back, and that's when I started to get in trouble.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. And that's when I came back. That's when I started to get in trouble. Yes, Your Honor. Now, in this statement,
the rule of completeness.
In this statement, certainly, appellant correlates the assault to his development of bipolar disorder. However, he does not correlate the bipolar disorder with the commission of the offenses. Instead, what the military judge hears is a laundry list of injuries sustained by appellant as a result of the assault, and he's listing them in sentencing as evidence and extenuation and mitigation. And it continues the theme in extenuation and mitigation immediately following thereafter. He tells him how he felt he was mistreated by his command, stating that he was denied convalescent leave and that he was only granted 8 days annual leave for Christmas. And he states when he got back from leave, that is when he got in trouble. This causal link is not as obvious as appellant would indicate, and there's actually no correlation at all. Rather, appellant's statement more readily correlates the commission of these offenses with his displeasure from being denied convalescent leave and feeling shortchanged on his Christmas leave. Essentially, it's awful editing on the part of the appellant in the unsworn statement where he tries to indicate that appellant told a military judge that the assault and the resulting bipolar disorder was a proximate cause of the commission of these offenses, and that was not the message of the military judge. The military judge saw the accused. There's a presumption of mental responsibility, Your Honor. The military judge had already received, prior to the unsworn statement, appellant service record book, which establishes this entire pattern of misconduct predates the assault.
Let's assume the defense is completely wrong on the issue of whether this, in fact, established a lack of mental responsibility. Why isn't the reference to bipolar syndrome, when connected to the offense by the appellant, sufficient to at least trigger an inquiry by the judge, to require the judge to say, okay, you've now identified a significant mental disease, one which has the potential for being a defense in this case. Similar to when people are involved in offenses and talk about going on drinking binges. And then the judge is required to inquire at that point as to whether there is a relationship to the underlying offense in those cases. Why isn't that sufficient here to at least trigger the requirement for an inquiry?
Certainly, Your Honor. The military judge could have ordered the inquiry, and as this court already stated earlier today, in a perfect world, we would have been, we wouldn't be here today.
Not even perfect world. Judge sitting there hearing bipolar syndrome, post-traumatic stress syndrome, those things which can potentially cause an individual to not have mental responsibility at the time of the offense. Why isn't that sufficient at that point to alert every military judge to inquire further?
Because at this trial, Your Honor, the military judge, after having observed the appellant throughout the trial, having engaged in dialogue with the appellant, engaged in the care inquiry with the appellant, has seen all the facts, and all these facts negated any potential offense by the time he got to it in the unsworn statement.
So is that what the government's relying on, that everything that was said negated the possibility of a defense? There was no possibility in this case of a defense of bipolar syndrome leading to lack of mental responsibility?
Not a possibility, Your Honor. Rather, all the facts negated the necessary inquiry by the military judge.
Okay.
In your response to Chief Judge Efron's question, are you factoring in the principle that this court has historically provided for preferential treatment of mental responsibility of armed forces members who are accused of a crime?
Yes, Your Honor. And the government does concede and acknowledge that this court historically has offer preferential treatment to military members in this particular situation.
And so when an accused makes a statement that references a potential mental defect, even with that preferential treatment that he should be given, it's not error for the military judge to make no further inquiry whatsoever.
Given the facts of this particular case, not at all, Your Honor. And again, it is not sufficient to ask the accused or to take the accused's opinion about a mental deficiency, especially in an unsworn statement.
I don't think that the defense is arguing that this statement establishes anything, that it establishes a defense, that it establishes any type of mental status. What they're saying is that it's enough of a flag that the military judge, under his responsibilities, should say, wait a minute, I need to look into this further under my responsibilities for the care inquiry. And that might have taken him 5 minutes. The result may well have been, after establishing the record, that this didn't warrant looking further into. We don't know that because he didn't make that inquiry. And I think that's what they're saying. They're saying, without any inquiry, we really don't know where this would have gone.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, the military judge certainly could have, based on the declaration of bipolar syndrome in the unsworn statement. However, the standard is, based on this record of trial, did the military judge abuse his discretion? Was his decision to accept the guilty plea arbitrary, fanciful, or clearly unreasonable? And in this situation, based on what he heard, Your Honor, care inquiry, everything, the entire facts of the case.
Well, okay. I mean, I think we're all in agreement that what he said in the care inquiry was satisfactory. What we have now is a statement after the care inquiry, and the question is whether or not that is sufficient to have the military judge reopen the care inquiry.
Not in this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, it appears to me that the reason they were there on that day and not some subsequent day was that they were operating on a pretrial agreement that had a drop-dead date.
Yes, sir.
He had to plead by that date or the agreement went away. In a situation like that where in the 802 some allusion is made to medical evidence and evidence in mitigation and extenuation, and that evident, and that isn't available because it didn't get there in time, and you've got a situation which he's got to plead that day or the PTA goes away. Does that impose any duty either on the judge or counsel to inquire further as to the effect of the PTA on his ability to make his defense?
Well, that inquiry did take place, Your Honor. Part of the province inquiry, the military judge did ask
the appellant, if he was pleading voluntarily, if he read the agreement, if he agreed to the PTA, if he signed the PTA, if pleading that day pursuant to that stipulation prevented him from offering evidence in extenuation and mitigation, and appellant stated on the record that it did not, Your Honor. So the military judge did indeed inquire as to the effect of that provision and how it affected him in establishing extenuation and mitigation, Your Honor.
Is it effective assistance of counsel for counsel not to try and get an extension from the convening authority in a situation like that?
Well, the record of trial doesn't establish that. Trial defense counsel did not attempt to get that.
No, there's nothing on it. Right.
And how would you distinguish Philip from this case, Philippe? You may recall the facts, if not the name, that's in the unsworn statement on a UA. The individual says he tried to turn himself into folks up in Montana, and they said, thanks, but go away. Do you know the case?
I'm not recalling that case.
It's hard to argue without the specific facts. In that case, the appellant said that he's charged with UA. He said that he'd gone to some base on or about 9/11 and turned himself in, but since it was the wrong service and they were otherwise in chaotic circumstances, so says his unsworn statement, he was not able to turn himself in, and they told him to come back another day. You can read the facts. I'm not trying to say those are the precise facts. And this court said, the issue in this case is whether the military judge should have inquired further into the providence of appellant's pleas in light of his unsworn statement. Even if an accused does not volunteer all the facts necessary to establish a defense, if he sets up matter raising a possible defense, then the military judge is obligated to make further inquiry to resolve any apparent ambiguity or inconsistency. Now, understanding you have the disadvantage of not having that text before you and so on, how would you distinguish your case from that case?
Well, in Philippe, Your Honor, they're throwing it out there that he set up matters inconsistent with his plea. And from what I take from that, I think that's where we're going with this, Your Honor. In this particular case, the bipolar disorder, the declaration of bipolar disorder, is not inconsistent with this plea, Your Honor. Essentially, it is, rather than being inconsistent with the plea, is this more in line with the fact that it's thrown up there as extenuation and mitigation, again, as established in the 802 pretrial conference. Page 13 of the record of trial, they established that it was extenuation and mitigation. And again, in the unsworn statement, Your Honor, it was thrown out there with all these other resulting injuries as extenuation and mitigation on sentencing. So it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of being inconsistent with the plea, Your Honor.
Counsel, could you point to something specific that ties the medical records that were discussed in the 802 with the word bipolar as it's used in the unsworn statement?
There is nothing, Your Honor.
We have no idea what medical records they were talking about in the 802, do we?
No, Your Honor.
They could be wholly unrelated to mental condition. Isn't that possible?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, would this be a different case if in his unsworn statement he suggested that that because of the bipolar disorder, because of the injuries to his head, that he thought that what he was doing was okay and only now realized the error of his ways, or words to that effect? I mean, something suggesting that the second prong of the defense of lack of mental responsibility, would this be a different case?
Yes, Your Honor, this would certainly be a different case. And that second prong of whether or not he was able to understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions, that would certainly be at issue in that particular situation. But again, those facts, Your Honor, are starkly different from what we're looking at in this particular situation.
Should the answer to the care question or this case depend on what is being alleged? Bipolar, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, fill in blank? Or is it let me leave it at that and see how you answer that.
Your Honor, the particular deficiency should not be an issue. And the elements, the first element specifically requires a mental deficiency. It could be anything, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar, schizophrenia, whatever. And, of course, this court has certainly already established that bipolar disorder certainly could lead somebody to be unable to understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of their actions. So the nature of the deficiency is really irrelevant, Your Honor. The important part are the facts surrounding it and the facts that indicate that because of that deficiency, he was unable to appreciate the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions. Now, given this entire dialogue between the military judge and appellant, it is clear to the military judge that appellant was able to understand the nature and quality of the wrongfulness of his actions, coupled with the acknowledgement of the wrongfulness of his actions in his unsworn statement. Appellant's pleas were factually based, and he did voluntarily and knowingly enter these pleas. The record of trial clearly indicates, Your Honor, that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in these pleas. Therefore, the government respectfully requests this court affirm the findings and sentence set forth and approved below. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Efron, to answer your question before regarding the affidavit, the statement from the accused is from the appellant is contained in paragraph 7 of his affidavit, and to quote it, I have no doubt that all of these problems, especially being bipolar, were driving factors in the misconduct that I committed. The government has conceded that.
Why does that raise the issue at this stage in the proceeding that he lacked the mental responsibility to be convicted? Saying that something was a driving factor, bipolarism, schizophrenia, whatever it is not a defense. Doesn't establish a defense. Why isn't the burden at this stage for the accused to come forward with something to show us that a 706 board would be productive?
Your Honor, it supports the appellant's assertion that this is more than just a possibility of a defense. It supports the appellant's assertion that this created a substantial basis of both law and fact, that the Providency inquiry should have been reopened. The Providency inquiry was disturbed at that point.
But this statement, the one that you and the Chief Judge are talking about, wasn't before the military judge.
No, Your Honor. I believe the issue arose when Chief Judge Efron asked me a question regarding the affidavit, and I couldn't find the exact quote from the appellant supporting the statement that was actually made to the military judge. The government has conceded that there is a policy consideration here, that it would have been prudent for the military judge to have asked this question. Now, in a sense, this policy...
Why is that a concession? Is that, are you claiming that's a legal concession, or the question was particularly posed as a legal policy question? So in fairness to the government, you're not running with that. Why is that a concession of law that benefits you?
It's a concession of fact, Your Honor, not of law. It's a concession of fact because the government has conceded that we have service members coming back from Iraq, from Afghanistan, with these issues. And so it rises to the forefront of this court's analysis what this court is going to do when these service members get in trouble and then they're faced with charges. And they raise the issue of, well, I have post-traumatic stress disorder. Is the military judge then going to just say what this judge said, okay, thank you, and that's it? Or is this court going to require that military judge to then reopen the Providency inquiry and ask more questions to satisfy himself that the appellant is indeed guilty, or perhaps he is not? And then it goes to whether or not he had a defense, and he does raise a legal question.
What's your request for relief here? Is it all or nothing?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant asks that this court set aside the findings and the sentence.
If we don't do that, you don't want a 706 board.
Alternatively, the appellant would, if the 706 board would then raise possibly the issues that Harris raised. The appellant has already been found by a medical doctor to be bipolar. And then we have the same issue that Harris has. We would then ask for a 39A session to determine whether or not the appellant has a defense, whether or not it affected the findings. And then we're back to the same issue as Harris. If the military judge at that point states that the appellant appreciated the wrongfulness of his conduct, but doesn't reopen the providence inquiry, then Harris would apply. Obviously, because this court has already decided Harris, the military judge would most likely state, no, we have a bipolar disorder, and I'm going to reopen providence inquiry. So in a sense, we get the same thing, Your Honor. So the appellant would certainly agree to a 706 if this court does not want to set aside the findings and sentence.
706 board said no issue of mental responsibility at the time of defense. It would be different, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor. Because the 706 board, if it finds that the appellant didn't have a bipolar disorder, that would be enough to trigger the Harris issue.
Can you take one? I'm sorry, are you done? Again, your argument on page 50, what is it precisely that alerts the judge to the fact that there may be something inconsistent with the provident plea?
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, it would be the mentioning that he has a bipolar disorder and coupling that with it having affected him having got into trouble right afterward.
So, mere mention of bipolar, having bipolar, and then I came back and that's when I started to get in trouble.
Yes, Your Honor.
Those are your factual elements to this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it matter for that factual evidence, for that factual basis that the military judge had before him, an NJP that occurred prior in time to any of these events?
No, Your Honor. And it wouldn't matter because the appellant qualified his statement by stating how he had gotten beat up after the NJP. And he didn't specifically mention the NJP, but he did state that he had gotten beat up. And it was after that beating that he was also diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and then he stated, and then after that, I started getting into trouble. So he did mention that he tied it to the bipolar disorder itself. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for your argument in the case. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.